I think it is a very significant movement. I think we will look back on this time and see that. And so that's my goal, is just to be helpful. And so what I thought I would do tonight, the first lecture, I'm going to do basically the history of the emerging church in the United States, and then talk about the different streams that I see, so that you can begin to understand, you know, those different ideologies and the things that influence them. And then we'll get to some Q&A. So if any time during I'm talking, as Dr. Guthrie said, write down your question. We're going to get to them. We're going to make room for that. That's really important. And a lot of this is just a discussion starter. And so hopefully we'll get there. And I'll be available during the breaks as well if you have something you just want to ask me personally. Let me kind of bring myself into this story, you know, a little bit about me, and then how this intersects into the history, because there is quite a few intersections. I was a binge drinking alcoholic, almost athlete in high school, very sexually promiscuous, just a mess. Didn't have a dad growing up, and so I just kind of did my own thing. When I got larger than my mom physically, I just kind of stayed out as late as I wanted and, you know, did whatever I wanted. Didn't go to church as a kid, didn't really hear the gospel, didn't understand. I remember asking one of my friends who brought his Bible all the time. He was the little nerdy Christian that always brought his Bible to class, and I just asked him. I said, I keep seeing this sign behind the goalpost, because I watch football on Sundays, and so that's how I worshiped. And so I saw this sign behind the goalpost that said, John, and then a colon, John 3, colon 16. And I said, what is that? I keep seeing that behind the goal. He said, well, that's, and he showed me in his Bible. Oh, okay. That's when I was 16 years old. And so, long story, but Jesus met me, opened my heart. I'm absolutely a Calvinist with a capital C, because I was not looking for God at all. And he rescued me from my sin and my shame and began to sanctify me. And my life has just absolutely changed, so much so that this was my junior year in high school. The summer before my senior year, I went to church camp, which I'd never done such a thing before, but I went to church camp. And the guy was up there speaking in a room just a little bit bigger than this, and I don't know what he was talking about, but God was talking to me. And that is when I now know, I didn't really know it then, quite honestly, that was my call to ministry. And kind of the practical legs for that was, felt like the Lord told me to go back to my high school and start a Bible study. And so I did that. And that Bible study grew to about 200 students. It was met on Friday nights. And out of that whole movement, pastors and missionaries and doctors and lawyers and accountants and construction workers and all kinds of people came to Christ and are still serving Christ today. It was literally the only time in my life that I've ever witnessed revival, because it hit our town, then two other towns in the same county in southern Illinois over about a two-year period. I've never seen anything like it. I've tried to reproduce it. It's not worked since, but it was just literally kind of a touch from God on our county with younger people. And so then what do you do when something like that happens? Well, you become a youth pastor, right? So I become a youth pastor, and I'm way too young, 19 years old, and had no business being a youth pastor. I had a lot of maturing to do, but this pastor took me in, and it turns out that this pastor was not so good of a guy. He was sleeping with three women in the church, and I actually kind of overheard a conversation and kind of brought it to the attention. A lot of the people in the church knew about it, and they covered it up. And I remember driving back from that confrontation thinking, if this is what ministry is, and if these are what pastors are, I'm not so sure I'm interested. I love Jesus, but I'm not so sure I love the church. And I don't think I love pastors. And so I really wrestled with kind of chucking the whole thing, quite honestly. But I couldn't shake it. I couldn't let it go. So I ended up going to Southwest Baptist University down in Bolivar, Missouri, and largely because they had this biblical languages program. I was really interested in studying Greek and Hebrew and biblical backgrounds, archaeology. So they had this great major. My friend had gone there. And so I went there and started to study, and an interesting thing started happening. I started having all of these kind of guys who really didn't fit in the church kind of pursuing me. athletes and artists, guys who were, you know, wrestling with same-sex attraction, guys who were wrestling with, you know, they were alcoholics and they were, but they were pastor's kids and just all kinds of different things. I had this whole ministry to guys, and I remember trying to take them to some of the churches down there, and there's some wonderful churches down there, don't get me wrong, but a lot of them didn't fit in these churches. And I remember thinking, you know, there needs to be a church for guys like this. And that's when the Lord began to talk to me about church planting. So I went up to seminary in Kansas City, at Midwestern Seminary, largely because a friend of mine's friend was planting a church up there. And the seminary gave me a full ride, and I'm all for free. So I went up there, and I helped plant a church. It was going about 8 months when I got there, and I started the student ministry, the ministry for junior high and high school kids. And just got in the kind of the trenches of a church plant. Meanwhile, the seminary had kind of gone through this shift that was more liberal leaning, and then they kind of, as happens, you kind of swing the pendulum too far. And so there was they attracted some students and some professors who were, you know, pretty hyper Calvinistic, in my opinion. They were on the cutting edge of the 1600s and their ministry methods. And I really honestly agreed with some of their critique of what was going on in the contemporary churches, but I didn't necessarily agree with the spirit. And this is students and professors. This isn't just professors. But I'm just thinking, what is the church supposed to be? I'm not sure. I don't know if it's supposed to be seeker-sensitive, seeker-insensitive. What do I do? So I found out about this church. This is in 1998, called Jacob's Well, which all the emerging churches had the weirdest church names, right? I mean, it's like, well, Jacob's, what is... And I remember, that's in the book Gospel of John, so that's kind of biblical. So I went and met with this guy, Tim. And he had started a church in urban Kansas City. And you just don't start churches in urban centers. I mean, you just didn't do that. If you wanted to start a church, you went out to the nice, safe suburbs, right? Well, this guy was in the hood in Kansas City. And I heard about it. I said, man, I got to meet this guy. So I started meeting with him. He usually bought lunch, which meant I was going to meet with him as often as I could. So I met with him, and he began to talk to me about this whole idea of the church needing to emerge. And he'd been on staff at a church like me, a seeker-sensitive church, and had kind of grown a little disillusioned, thought maybe there's another, you know, option here. So we started talking. He offered me a job. I said, no, I'm called to plant a church. I'm hanging out with you so you can teach me. He said, well, you know, I can help, but you need to do some reading on your own. You need to figure this thing out. So I started, he sent me to a website called The Ooze. It's still around. And it was all about the emerging church. He told me about Acts 29, which hadn't even started yet, actually. He said it's theologically driven and they have money for new churches. And I liked both of those things because I needed both of those. And then he said, you should go to this church called Pathways Church. In Denver, and Tim had just finished a internship there when he was going to Denver Seminary, and I'd actually met the pastor Ron Johnson at another event that I was at, and so I just called Ron. I said, "Hey, could I come? And I need one day with you. Could I stay at your house? I'll be in the mountains the rest of the time. I just need to process this whole church planting thing. That's I feel called to an urban area, but I don't know what that looks like. I grew up in the sticks, and now I'm in the suburbs, and I'm kind of freaked out. Would you help me?" He's like, "Yeah, come and stay." So I get there, like at 1 in the morning, my flight's delayed, and I get to his house. I'm knocking on the door. Nobody's answering. He forgot that I was even coming. So he gets up. He's got his pajamas on. I'm like, "Hey, I'm so-and-so." He looked at me like really strange. "Oh, yeah, come on. You can sleep on the couch." So he talked to me and basically told me pretty straight up, that I was soft and I needed just to man up and go plant a church and quit talking about it. So after that display of gentleness, I thought, yeah, that would be great. I should really think about doing that. And I said, well, where do I plant a church? I said, I'm living in Kansas City, but there's like 4 church plants in this urban area and there's not a ton of population down there yet. He said, well, where are you from? I said, well, I'm from this little town 2 hours south of St. Louis you've never heard of. I mean, he goes, well, what about St. Louis? And I was like, I've never thought about that. Go back, one of the girls on our staff was from St. Louis, and she said, you know, I've heard you kind of talking about this, what you want to do in staff meetings. You should go to St. Louis. you should think about that. So I'm driving in the mountains. I'm going back and forth, typical emerging church. You don't have linear thought. And so I'm back in the mountains in Colorado after meeting with the guy at Pathways. I'm driving. I'm processing what this girl said in the staff meeting. This is actually before what Ron said. And then I'm just thinking, okay, what do I do? How do I do this? The Rams were playing in the NFC Championship. This is now 1999 when this all happened. And I was watching the Rams, and just all the, it was like, this is where I'm supposed to go. So I start making trips to St. Louis. I meet with PCA pastors. I meet with EPC pastors. I meet with Baptist pastors. I meet with Vineyard pastors. I meet with any pastor that will meet with me, and just basically waiting for somebody to tell me that I'm crazy and don't even try this, honestly. And all of them said, I think what you're talking about would work. If the Lord's calling you to do it, you should come. So we moved to St. Louis. And I'd heard about this thing, Acts 29, and so we went to a boot camp. Now, it was not a boot camp like you would think boot camp. It was a cruise boot camp, which is really oxymoronish. But the co-founder of Acts 29 is a PCA pastor by the name of David Nicholas in Boca Raton, Florida, and he had these connections to the cruise line somehow. So we're doing this cruise, and that's where I met Mark Driscoll. And when I met Mark Driscoll, it was like I'd met my long-lost brother. We both grew up in kind of a blue-collar home, kind of a rough background, and it was just like, man, this is my guy. And we began to talk, and this was in 2001. Actually, we were on the fast-forwarding now. We were in the Bahamas when 9/11 happened. So they are. All the people from New York around the cruise were freaking out. They're hauling off every Middle Eastern person in handcuffs on the ship. It was chaos. We get back. Driscoll calls me up and says, hey, we want you to be in Acts 29. So we were one of the first churches in the Acts 29 network, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So that's kind of my introduction. And as I continue to tell the story, it'll make a little bit more sense, some of the characters. But this whole topic of the emerging church, what's funny is it sounds like it's new. Let me show you something here. These are all books. That one on the left was published in 1970. And the one in the middle, I think, was also in the 70s. And I think the one on the right was actually in, like, 1980. So the idea of this has been around for a while. In 2001, Karen Ward, who's one of the leaders in the conversational emerging church, which I'll define for you in a moment, purchased the website emergingchurch.org. Dan Kimball, who's another leader, purchased the website emergingchurch.net in 2001 as well. In 2001, Emergent Village purchased the website emergentvillage.org. And then in 2001 also, the emergingchurch.com was purchased by Youth Specialties. And so this whole term started kind of coming in vogue right around this time. And then a book was published in 2003 by Dan Kimball called The Emerging Church. Now, as I said earlier, I'm going to focus on the U.S. side. If you want to get the U.K. side and some stuff in Europe, I suggest Tony Jones and his new book, The New Christians, Dispatches from the Emergent Frontier. The New Christians, Dispatches from the Emergent Frontier. And Andrew Jones, who is also called the Tall, Skinny Kiwi. He's a New Zealander. And he can help you with all that other stuff. And he's got a blog, and he's very thorough and very smart. And I recommend those, too. I'm going to focus on the U.S. because... I think it's easier for me to track. I've interviewed Mark Driscoll, Chris C., Rick McKinley, Tony Jones, Doug Padgett, who all of those guys I consider friends, though we have disagreements. And I have read everything I could get my hands on from Rob Bell, Dan Kimball, and Brian McLaren, who have basically listened to lectures and read their books for 9 years. And what I see is this movement began to take shape in the kind of mid-90s, early 90s, mid-90s. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of note the situation in life of many of these early shapers from the interviews that I've done. And I'm especially grateful to Tony Jones, who helped me fill in the gaps by sending me an advanced copy of that book that I mentioned, which chronicles some of the movement. So I'm going to do some key players, and then I'm going to do some key events. And then we'll take a break and get into some of the popular terms, and then we'll do some Q&A. Sound fair? In the mid-90s, Jack Caputo hosted a conference at Villanova University on postmodern philosophy. And he featured this guy, Jacques Derrida, as well as some others. And Caputo heard that an evangelical pastor from Texas was in the crowd. And this so astounded him that from the stage, he says, "I heard there's a pastor here, something Cecil. I'd like to meet him. Please come and see me." That was Brad Cecil. And Caputo could not understand why Cecil, an American-married evangelical pastor, would want to hear from Derrida, a French gay atheist philosopher. It astounded him, and he had to meet this person. Right around this time, Mark Driscoll, after studying communications and philosophy and epistemology at Washington State University, was planting Marcel Fellowship in Seattle. Doug Padgett was serving as a youth pastor and growing increasingly disheartened with its theology and practice. Ron Johnson, after pioneering three churches, was planting Pathways Church in Midtown Denver. Tim Keel was finishing up Denver Seminary and interning at Ron Johnson's Pathways Church in Denver, getting ready to plant Jacob's Well in Kansas City. Brian McLaren was serving as a pastor in the suburb of Washington, D.C., and had yet to publish a book. Donald Miller was getting sick of the legalism and lack of life in his church. Karen Ward was working for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in denominational life. Andrew Jones, the tall, skinny Kiwi, was starting a church for goth kids in Portland, Oregon. Chris C. was planting a church for college students at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and was beginning to invest in a young, shy, insecure guitarist that you may have heard of named David Crowder. Dieter Zander had just left New Song Church in San Dimas, California, which by all accounts is the first emerging postmodern Gen X church, whatever you want to call it, planted in 86, to develop the Axis Ministry at Willow Creek. Dan Kimball and his hair was watching his youth ministry at Santa Cruz Bible Church take on a life of its own as Graceland. He's a big Elvis fan. He kind of looks like Elvis. Sunday night service. Erwin McManus had just accepted a call to pastor the Church on Brady, which was eventually renamed to Mosaic Church in Los Angeles. Rob Bell was on staff at Calvary Church, a seeker-sensitive church in Grand Rapids, Michigan, under the leadership of Dr. Ed Dobson. Theologians Stan Grenz, the late Stan Grenz, and John Frank were working on a book called Beyond Foundationalism, which is an attempt at an evangelical justification for new forms of theology. So all this stuff is happening right around this time. And all of these men realized something was wrong with the way the church was contextualizing the gospel, as evidenced by the droves and droves of young people who were leaving the church. And these men were not the only ones concerned. A ministry called Leadership Network was concerned. The Leadership Network is a ministry based out of Dallas, and in 1997, they asked Doug Padgett, who was a youth pastor at Wooddale Church, pastored by Leif Anderson in Minnesota, to run a new initiative. Doug was charged with gathering the next generation of evangelical leaders. No pressure. Doug traveled around the country to find what they call innovators, and he invited them to what Leadership Network calls a learning community. And one of the first gatherings he hosted, we're going to move to key events now, took place at the Glen Erie Mansion outside of Colorado Springs. He had tapped a dozen young leaders to come for this first gathering to talk about ministry to Gen Xers. I love that term, Gen Xers. Gen X 1.0 was the name of the gathering in 1997. Now, the common wisdom of the time was that the changes that were happening were based on generational theory. And so the issue was, all these people born between 1965 and 1980, they think differently than the baby boomers, so we got to adapt ministry. The Gen X, the busters, they need a new style of ministry. Kind of leading the charge in that was Dieter Zander and Tim Selleck, who published this book, Inside the Soul of a New Generation, in, I believe, 1996. And so they were kind of leading the charge. My pastor at the time in Kansas City, I was a youth pastor, remember, I was trying to convince him of this, that this was a generational thing, and that's why he didn't understand, and he needed to listen to me, and so I was really passionate about this whole generational theory. But according to Jones and others, at this first event, Brad Cecil, remember the guy that was at the Derrida conference that the guy called him out and couldn't believe he was there, got up, and he challenged this conventional wisdom of the day. The previous talk had been, let's attract Gen Xers back to the church by basically doing what Hybels and Warren did. Let's make church cool for younger people. That's the issue. Cecil got up and went to the whiteboard and in the room, and he began drawing diagrams all over the place, explaining that the shifts were much more profound than simple generational differences. He says the Middle Ages were characterized by mysticism. This is Brad Cecil. God was the author of all. But in the modern period, starting in the 17th century, man was seen as the author. And we entered into an age of empiricism. Now, he continued, we're experiencing the postmodern turn toward an age of enlightened mysticism. And by the time Brad was done, the board was covered with a timeline stretching from Jesus to the present and littered with names like Foucault, Descartes, Rorty, and Kant. Brad later turned this talk into a PowerPoint presentation, which has legendary status among emergents. I think I actually viewed this in Tim Keel's office. His argument was this: the issue was not generational. It was epistemological. And so there was this huge kind of divide in the room. Dieter Zander, Tim Selleck, guys who wrote the book, were like, no, that's not right. It's age, it's generation, not worldview. Driscoll, Chris C., Doug Padgett basically agreed with Cecil. And Tony Jones writes, they decided that Brad was on to something and that he got it, whatever it was. They called Brad over to the corner of the room during the next coffee break and began pointing out others in the room. Does he get it? Does he get it? They were splitting the room between those who understood Brad's presentation and those didn't. And for their part, Doug, Chris, and Mark were interested in spending time with those who got it. Get what? Brad replied. You know, the stuff you just talked about. The four of them couldn't articulate the it, but they could feel it. It was like the beginning of something new and the overthrow of something old. It felt like, to them, the burgeoning of a whole new way of understanding who they were as Christians and what the church was supposed to look like. These guys, Chris C., Doug Padgett, and Mark Driscoll, under the direction of Padgett, under the leadership of Leadership Network, formed what was called the Young Leaders Network. They began traveling the country looking for others who got it. And this is a slide from Leadership Network in April of 2000, where the term emerging church was first used. Let me give you a little history on that. Dan Kimball writes in Next Wave, kind of a history of this. Let me read it to you. It's helpful to understand how this term came about. He writes, since Leadership Network was hosting these events specifically focused on younger generations and their tagline was Advanced Scouts for the Emerging Church, it slowly began being used as emerging as a substitute word for what was called Baby Busters, then Gen X, then Postmodern. Emerging was the final word. When we realized that the Gen X thing was not just an age group thing, but a cultural change, it shifted to postmodern, which soon became totally misunderstood and equated with a style of music or ministry or worship service rather than a philosophical response to modernism. And since most of us were not philosophers and realized we were in way over our heads even trying to explain it, so the word emerging church seemed safer and more non-age specific and began being used more and more, not only for churches and ministries focused on younger generations, but also for churches focusing on the fact that culture was really shifting and changing. So the term moved past a generational focus to more of a cultural focus. Then in 1987, they had Gen X 2.0, and Mark Driscoll spoke. And this was kind of Mark Driscoll's coming out party, in a sense. He basically articulated that the change that was happening was not a generational issue. And all this kind of coalesced in his mind because he had studied epistemology in college and had become a Christian in college. And he was kind of brought all this together. And Mark is a brilliant communicator. And at that conference in Mount Hermon, California, really kind of set the stage for this idea that it's not a generational thing. Another thing happened at that conference. Mark took the stage and he told me the story personally that as he took the stage, he began to see in his mind that many of the young leaders who were at the conferences, who were at that conference were committing adultery, and had done some really had some hidden sin in their life, and he just began to pray what he was seeing in his mind. And a couple of guys actually repented, I believe, at the conference. But in the coming years, it was discovered that many of these young leaders had basically disqualified themselves from ministry, and God had showed Mark that from the stage. It was quite an event. In 1998, Brian McLaren, a pastor from the burbs of D.C., joined this group that was traveling around the country. And that's Brian. And Brian is a very influential guy. He's very winsome, very, very nice guy, very winsome. But that began to kind of change the tone of the group. And Ellen kind of saw the writing on the wall. And if you know anything about Leadership Network, they're very atheological by nature, because what they want to do is gather pastors and ministry leaders from all across the spectrums and get them to basically learn best practices from each other. And so they were seeing that this whole movement was becoming very theological, and they said, you know what, guys, I don't think that's where we're going. And so Padgett left, who was the leader of the Young Leader Network, under Leadership Network, and went to plant a church called Solomon's Porch in Minneapolis. This group kind of followed Doug, and they eventually became what was known as the Terra Nova Project. And in my interview with Doug, he said that the shift was apparent and very evident early on in Terra Nova, because this is a direct quote. He said, it became about rethinking everything, not just church and ministry style, but also the content of Scripture. Now, it's here that Driscoll began to be a little disturbed, because the conversation seemed to be shifting from changing the church to contextualize the gospel in culture to changing the gospel to contextualize it in culture. And things got very heated at a certain planning meeting when Tony Jones began to join the party. Tony is now the national coordinator for Emergent Village. Tony, at a Mexican restaurant, writes this. He said, I ended up sitting across from Brad Cecil. The two of us got to talking, and I can't remember the exact trajectory of the conversation, but I do remember saying at a somewhat inopportune time, in a far too loud a voice, the Bible is propaganda. It came out, even though I didn't believe it, and I'd never really thought about it, but to be honest, I was a bit amazed that I'd even said it. Everyone else at the table looked at me, their face betraying the thought, who's the new guy? As one does in these situations, I began to feverishly defend my position, even in the face of Brad's face and cries of, you got to be kidding me, that's crazy. Propaganda has a point and a purpose, I retorted. It doesn't claim to be objective. It's trying to convince someone of something. It's trying to get people to join a cause, a movement. Isn't that what the Bible is about? And Tony writes, particularly torqued at this assertion was Mark Driscoll, who let me know how much he disagreed with me. Would love to know exactly what was said there. Later on in 1999, there was a regional conference event for this group. And it was there that Driscoll drew the line theologically, saying that he was Reformed, that he believed that only men should be elders, and that that's where he was theologically. And so what happened was, these group of men who had coveted together to be friends, this group of men who had shared meals together with their families, this group of men who had begin to talk about theology and focus on that, not best practices, would now be separated by theology. Mark Driscoll writes, I eventually had to distance myself from the emergent stream of the network because friends like Brian McLaren and Doug Padgett began pushing a theological agenda that greatly troubled me. Examples include referring to God as a chick, questioning God's sovereignty over and knowledge of the future, denial of the substitutionary atonement at the cross, a low view of Scripture, and a denial of hell, which is one hell of a mistake. Tony Jones and Doug Padgett and Chris C. have a little different take on that. They say that Mark was divisive and harsh with his language, and despite attempts to ask Mark to tone down and submit to the group, he refused. So in late 2000, David Nicholas from Spanish River Church in Boca Raton and Mark Driscoll formed the Acts 29 Network with a mission of churches planting churches, male elders, reformed soteriology, church planting churches. 2001, Emergent Village was formed with a mission of being a growing generative friendship among missional Christians seeking to love our world in the spirit of Jesus Christ. No statement of faith for Emergent Village. Now, as I see it, these two movements are the most influential in the emerging church. Acts 29 to the right, Emergent Village to the left, theologically. And so what I want to do is actually add another stream to this, because this is in the last couple of years, as I said, the conversation has gotten very nuanced. And you have to understand that the emerging church cannot be separated from the postmodern situation in which it finds itself. And so it's been notoriously slippery. Classification is a very unpostmodern thing to do. And the point with my taxonomy is that emerging churches are not monolithic, and that's what I really want to, I hope to help you understand. So I actually see three streams, and everybody has given their streams and their thoughts, and so I'll just add mine to the pile. But since I'm here, I'll give them to you. The first one I'll classify as emerging conversational. The emerging conversational stream, their main focus, in my view, is theological revision. They are interested in the Missio Dei, the mission of God, which we will actually talk about in the second lecture, and how that's a little different than the other side. A lot of bloggers in this conversation. Driscoll refers to some of these guys as those who blog in their pajamas while living in their mom's basement. So those are his words. Those aren't mine. A lot of bloggers. And a lot of bivocational pastors. So a lot of pastors who actually make their living traveling, speaking, and then are in this conversation. A lot of seminary students. A lot from mainline seminaries are in this conversation. That would be classified emerging conversational. Theologians that the emerging conversational, they look at. Scott McKnight, who is a professor at Park, I believe. The late Stan Grins, Nancy Murphy, Miroslav Volf, Croatian theologian, Walter Brueggemann, and many others. I could name a ton, but those are some of them. Some of the people that I would put in this group, Doug Padgett, Tim Keel, a pastor in Kansas City, Karen Ward, who's a pastor of Apostles Church out in Seattle, Rob Bell, pastor of Mars Hill Mars Hill Bible Church in Grand Rapids, and Brian McLaren, who used to be a pastor and now travels and speaks. And what I see from the emerging conversational group is that they really are about challenging evangelical theology and reframing it. Brian McLaren's new book is called Everything Must Change. And I've read excerpts and reviews, and a couple of my good friends have read the book. And they say that what he hinted at in some of his other books, he is now completely, in their opinion, left evangelicalism. That book's coming out. Heavy on critique, and then kind of, instead of just alluding to things, actually is kind of moving in a new direction, hence the title of the book, Everything Must Change. The second group I'll highlight is what I call emerging attractional. I'll explain that in a second. They are after mainly revision in methods. And I say attractional because they highlight large group worship, as opposed to the last group that I'll mention, the incarnational guys who downplay large group worship. But there's two streams within this one. They're the Reformed, the Neo-Calvinist that has been written about so much. Some of the theologians they look to, Piper, Graham Goldsworthy, Chris Wright, Wayne Grudem, Tim Keller, classic theologians like Calvin and Luther. Some of the guys in this group, Matt Carter, is a pastor in Austin Stone Church in Austin, Texas. Chris Tomlin is his worship leader, a very large church, doing some great things in Austin. Matt Chandler, pastor of the Village Church in Dallas, Texas. Mark Driscoll, pastor of Mars Hill Church in Seattle. Daniel Montgomery, pastor of Sojourn Church in Louisville, Kentucky. And David Fairchild, pastor of Kaleo Church in San Diego. I would put myself in that group as well. There's also a group of non-Reformed, kind of the neo-seeker guys like Andy Stanley. Not sure where to put Dan Campbell. I'll put him here. I'm sure he'll disagree with me, but he can do that. John Burke, pastor also in Austin. He was on the leadership team at Willow Creek before he planted. Perry Noble. This is a guy who planted a church in the middle of the sticks in Anderson, South Carolina, wherever that is. Church has grown to like 9,000 people. Just amazing. Erwin McManus. And another guy that I'll throw in because he's local and he's doing some great things is Greg Holder at Windsor Crossing Community Church, which is a church about 15 minutes from here in the Chesterfield Valley. And what you have here, though, there's differences between a Reformed soteriology and a more an Arminian soteriology is both the Reformed guys and the emerging guys and the emerging attractional guys, both the Reformed guys and the non-Reformed guys in this emerging attractional crowd are creative. They take risks. They're not afraid to use different methods to reach people. And so, the highlight for them is that they're trying to create an environment and a large group worship time that is accessible for people. And there's varying degrees of that. The Reformed guys tend to do it with Bible exposition, verse by verse, book by book, preaching of the Bible. The non-Reformed guys tend to do it through topics and things of that nature. Last group that we'll hit is the emerging incarnational. These guys are mainly after structural revision in the church. They tend to downplay large corporate worship time, and they are the house church guys for the most part. Now, I need to say this because it's important. There's sometimes a bifurcation between attractional and incarnational, and I actually think that's wrong. I think you can be attractional and incarnational. And so just because you have you kind of emphasize your corporate worship experience doesn't mean you can't be incarnational. But the reason I label these guys this way is because they really think that simple structures in the church, that's really what they're passionate about. That's what they're after. And actually, sometimes they float more on the right or to the left theologically. They kind of go in between. I think the right is the emerging attractional guys. The left is the emerging conversational guys. And these incarnational guys, these house church guys, kind of float in between depending on who they are. Guys like Alan Hirsch. And Lance Ford, who's actually from St. Louis, who have formed this ministry called Shapevine, which is a resource ministry for pastors, and they're planting house churches all over the place. Bob Hyatt, who's a pastor in Portland, Oregon. Neil Cole, who's written a ton of books on this kind of stuff. Another guy who I think is really brilliant, Jonathan Stuart Campbell. He wrote a book called The Way of Jesus. And another guy, Rob Turner, who's got a mega church that he's trying to turn into a house church in Dayton, Ohio. Good luck to you, Rob. I'm praying for you, buddy. So, clarify once again. To the left, we have the emerging conversational crowd. To the right, we have the emerging attractional crowd. And then the emerging incarnational guys kind of fluctuate. And I hope that's helpful just in kind of giving you kind of the lay of the land of regarding where these groups are at. And in your Q&A, you can flesh that out a little bit more and maybe, ask specific questions about that. Okay, so hopefully you wrote down some good questions, and that's really going to be the most helpful as we think about this. And even as people are coming up to me, it's very difficult, and it is like drinking from a fire hydrant if you're not versed. And so don't be afraid to write down your question. No question is... there are no stupid questions. Stupid people may ask questions, but there are no stupid questions. I just want you to know that. Okay, what we're going to talk about now, before we get into some Q&A, is the popular terms used by the emerging church. And before we get at that, I'll give you a few definitions of the emerging church. Hopefully that'll be helpful to you. Justin Taylor, who's working on the ESV study Bible, he used to work with John Piper, now he's working with the ESV. He says the emerging church are those who are seeking to incarnate and contextualize poor postmoderns. Wikipedia, that wonderful online dictionary, says the emerging church seeks to deconstruct and reconstruct Christianity for those residing in postmodern cultures. Eddie Gibbs and Ryan Bolger, who have written a book on churches in the postmodern context, say emerging churches are communities who practice the way of Jesus. That's a very common little phrase there within postmodern cultures. Ryan teaches out at, I think both those guys teach at Fuller Seminary. And so the issue here is that the emerging church shares some terminology, but at times they have different meanings. And so I hope to help you understand that. And the first two that I'm going to share are going to be longer than the other ones, okay? So I'm going to go into a little bit more detail because, in my opinion, they're the two most pivotal terms, concepts used. And I'll elaborate a little bit more. And this will be a good discussion starter for the Q&A time as well. The first word is the word missional. The word missional. And that's simply the adjectival use of the word missionary, okay? And it's not just the emerging church that's using these words. And I'm going to rely heavily on Dr. Ed Stetzer during this discussion of the word missional. Ed works for the Southern Baptist for Lifeway Research. He's their research missiologist. Probably the smartest guy on these kind of issues, along with Tim Keller, that are out there. Ed is unbelievable, and he's done a ton of study. And what he's noticed is that almost every denomination is using this word now. Southern Baptist, all the time. The Wesleyan Church, their evangelism and church growth team explains, we exist, kind of talking about why their mission statement, the Wesleyan Church evangelism and growth team, we exist and equip and empower the Wesleyan Church to become a missional movement through multiplying believers, leaders, and churches. The Assembly of God Department of U.S. Missions includes missional as one of their four values. The E-Free Church, the Evangelical Free Church, has renamed their church planting leadership missional church planting team. The Nazarene Church's denomination has adopted missional as their denominational goal. They describe themselves as Christian, holiness, and missional. And Randy Pope, pastor of Perimeter Church in Atlanta, preached a message at last summer's Presbyterian Church in America, the PCA General Assembly, entitled "The PCA, a Missional Church?" From 1 Corinthians 9:19 through 23. So it's a term that's used all the time. I first heard the term from the Gospel and Culture Network, their website, years ago, which was heavily influenced by Leslie Newbegin, who was a British missionary who went to India. And so that's where that kind of framed the discussion for me. Three of the early works, and Stetzer says these are the three most influential. Francis Dubose, who wrote The God Who Sends in 1983. Chuck Van Ingen, who is, we'll talk about more in a second, wrote God's Missionary People in 1991. And then Daryl Guder, who was the editor, wrote The Missional Church in 1998. And this book was probably the most influential book with regard to the term missional and what it means. And though Guder was most influential, Stetzer points out a very interesting thing, that it's actually the discussion between Dubose and Van Ingen that revealed the divide that we're now seeing with this term missional that's actually been brewing for 70 years between missiologists. The divide over this word goes back to two missions conferences early in the 20th century. In 1928, in Jerusalem, there was a missions conference. And the title of the conference was The World Mission of Christianity. 10 years later, at Tamborum, which is a suburb of Chennai in India, the conference was titled The World Mission of the Church. 1928, Jerusalem, The World Mission of Christianity. 1938, in India, The World Mission of the Church. Now, this shift in the title is very subtle, but very important. at Tamboram, the conversation shifted from the mission of God to the mission of God through the church. I quote this from that conference in 1938. It is the church and church alone which can carry the responsibility of transmitting the gospel from one generation to another, of preserving its purity and proclaiming it to all creatures. It is the church and church alone which can witness to the reality that man belongs to God in Christ with a higher right than that of any other earthly institution which may claim its supreme allegiance. It is within the church and the church alone that the fellowship of God's people receive together the gifts he offers to his children in word and sacrament. The message at Tamboram was that the church is at the center of God's plan. And there was a strong reaction to this kind of ecclesiological approach to missions, this ecclesiocentric approach. Johannes Hukendijk, I hope I pronounced that right, and others sought to basically define mission outside of the church. Stetzer writes, Hukendijk challenged the member bodies in the World Council of Churches, if you're familiar with that body, to abandon both the traditional form of church and its traditional approach to missions. He held, get this, that congregations should abandon their buildings and institutions and become bands of roving ministers, believing that the time for evangelical mission work had passed. This is what he called participating in the Missio Dei. Now, the Missio Dei literally means the mission of God. And in the Evangelical Dictionary of Missions, under the heading of Missio Dei, Hukendijk challenged missionaries, it says, to identify and integrate with the suffering masses, seeking to realize God's shalom on the earth. This is his idea of missions. Listen, as occurred in the 60s and 70s, the World Council's ministry focused almost entirely on social, economic, and political liberation to the neglect of personal conversion. Stetzer writes, in essence, those espousing the Missio Dei concept understood mission as our participation in the sending of God. Instead, the concept of sending, Missio, became focused as the derivative from the very nature of God, not from the church. That is, mission was put in the context of the Trinity instead of the context of ecclesiology or soteriology. Mission is not, therefore, primarily an activity of the church, but an attribute of God. Mission is a movement of God to the world, the church being the instrument for mission. There is a church because there is mission, not vice versa. So then, it is not only possible, but probable, that the main activity of God exists outside the church. Now, this is the position of the emerging conversational church as I see it. That the main stuff that's happening in the world is really not through the church, which is why conversations are needed outside of the church, because that's really where God is working. They don't say that the church is not important. They essentially say that it's not central to God's mission. And you see this very clearly in that many emerging conversational types no longer plant churches. The early call, and I remember listening to tapes and participating in conversations in the 90s, and the early call was, we got to plant churches all over the place, and the emerging conversational guys no longer talk about that and no longer do it for the most part. The action is outside of the church. Missional happens in spite of the church, in a sense. Now, for the emerging attractional and some incarnational, the church is the primary instrument in the world that spearheads God's mission, as evidenced by churches' commitment to plant churches and other campuses. And you see this with groups like Acts 29, GlocalNet, that are rapidly planting churches and multiplying their churches into other campuses and other neighborhoods. Here's where I want to bring in Van Egan. Van Egan is the professor of biblical theology of mission at Fuller Seminary. And this is his full definition of missional, and I think it'll be helpful at this point. He says, with the term missional, I emphasize the essential nature and vocation of the church as God's called and sent people. A missional ecclesiology is the biblical, historical, contextual, praxeological, means it can be translated into practice, and eschatological. The word missional, with reference to the church, sees the church as the instrument of God's mission. Following Newbegin and others, a church that is missional understands that God's mission calls and sends the church of Jesus Christ, both locally and globally, to be a missionary church in its own society, in the cultures in which it finds itself, and globally among the peoples who do not yet confess Jesus as Lord. Mission is the result of God's initiative, rooted in God's purposes to restore and heal creation and call people into a reconciled covenantal relationship with God. Mission means sending. And it is a central biblical theme describing the purpose of God's action in human history, with the church being the primary agent of God's missional action. As I said, many emerging conversational and some emerging incarnational types believe that the church is not the primary action of God's, primary agent of God's action. The emerging attractional types and some emerging incarnational types strongly believe that the church is the primary action and agent of God's action. So missional is one of those buzzwords that floats around. And when you hear it and somebody says it, it would not be impolite to ask them to define what they mean, because there are many definitions. Next word, kingdom. I said I'm going to spend more time on the first two and then spend less time. So there's some detail here. This is important though. Graham Goldsworthy, he's a guy I've gotten recently addicted to, his writings and others have told us that there's two ways to read the Bible. And it seems like depending on what these two ways are, the way that you read the Bible basically filters, informs how you view the biblical concept of the kingdom of God. Now, I'm going to lean heavily at this point on the foundational documents for a new organization called the Gospel Coalition, who Dr. Chappell is a part of creating these foundational documents, along with many others, D.A. Carson, Tim Keller. And so I'm going to quote heavily from that to help us understand these two approaches to reading the Bible. There is the synchronic approach, which is when you read, syn means to kind of read along with, right? To read along with the Bible, to discern the basic plot line of the Bible as a story of redemption, as Jesus informed the disciples on the road to Emmaus in Luke 24, when he basically told them, the way you understand the gospel is to see me there. The way to understand the Old Testament is to see me there. And so this is the synchronic approach. The gospel appears synchronically as creation, fall, redemption, restoration. This way of reading the Bible brings out the purpose of salvation, namely a renewed creation. Now, the diachronic approach is when you read across the whole Bible. To read across the whole Bible is to collect its declarations, summons, promises, truth claims into categories of thought, theology, Christology, etc., and arrive at a coherent understanding of what it teaches. In this way of reading the Bible, the gospel appears as God, sin, Christ, faith. I've said it so many times I've forgotten what I'm talking about. God, sin, Christ, faith. It brings out the means of salvation, namely the substitutionary work of Christ, and our responsibility to embrace it by faith. Jesus Christ acted as our representative and substitute so that we might become the righteousness of God, 2 Corinthians 5:21. Now, when you read it diachronically, the gospel appears as I said, God, sin, Christ, faith. It brings out the means, not the purpose, the idea of the substitutionary work of Christ. That's diachronic. Now, at this point, it's important to understand the conversational aspect and how they look at this, because it really kind of hits home. And I think the Gospel Coalition documents, specifically their theological vision for ministry, which I highly recommend going to their website and checking all that out. Specifically, their little nuanced question: how should we read the Bible? The hermeneutical issue. It says many today, talking about conversational types, many today, but not all, dwell on the more corporate aspects of sin and salvation. The cross is seen mainly as an example of sacrificial service and a defeat of worldly powers rather than substitution and propitiation for our sins. Many of these conversational types would agree with Jacques Mathai, the executive secretary for the Ecumenical Mission Study in the World Council of Churches. This is what he says: taking that the concept of the mission of God, the Missio Dei, theological entry point into the world is when God acts by and through the poor, the victims and the excluded. The aim of God's action, described as shalom, is also defined in the sense that God aims first at the liberation of the poor, a liberation that will bring about changed relations in the world, also the liberation of the rich and powerful. The poor and their fate thus becomes the yardstick for judging all social, political, economic, religious, and missionary developments and programs. For emerging conversational types, the kingdom is basically about bringing justice to the poor, the disenfranchised, and the hurting. And the gospel is reduced to an affront against corporate evil. And this is a reaction, quite honestly, as is all of the emerging church. It's a protest movement. It's a reaction against older evangelicals who, reading again from the Gospel Coalition documents, tended to read across the Bible. And as a result, it was more individualistic, centering almost completely on personal conversion and a safe passage to heaven. Also, its preaching through expository sermons was sometimes moralistic and did not emphasize how all the biblical themes climax in Christ and His work. And in this imbalance, there is little or no emphasis on the importance of the work of justice and mercy for the poor and the oppressed, and on cultural production that glorifies God in the arts and business. So they've reacted against an individualistic message and basically said the kingdom is not about individuals, it's about corporate. Sin is not really personal, it's corporate. Now the attractional incarnational crowd are also reacting, but they don't feel like you have to choose between a synchronic and a diachronic reading of Scripture. That's a false dichotomy. They also see the synchronic approach leads to legalism. Again, reading from the Gospel Coalition documents, instead of calling people to individual conversion through a message of grace, people are called to join the Christian community and the kingdom program of what God is doing to liberate the world. The emphasis is on Christianity as a way of life to the loss of a blood-bought status in Christ received through personal faith. In this imbalance, there is little emphasis on vigorous evangelism, apologetics, on expository preaching, and on the marks and importance of the conversion and new birth. So the emerging attractional guys are looking at the guys who are emphasizing the kingdom as corporate and saying, I don't like that option either. Why do we have to choose? Why can't we have both? Why do we have to pit them against each other? Why can't we read them together? Why can't we see that the Bible is about personal conversion and the gospel is about that, but it's also about a renewed creation? Why can't we do both? Graham Goldsworthy says this: we need both readings because we must accurately describe details and at the same time get the big picture. The conversational guys love the big picture, right? The older evangelicals love the nuances, the systematic theology, and what we're saying as emerging attractional and some emerging incarnational is, why do we have to choose? Why can't we have both? Kingdom is a huge issue. Brian McLaren's new book, if you want the side of the conversation, read that book. That really tells you where that's going in that conversation. Okay, let me be more brief now. I know I read a lot to you. Missional and kingdom. The next one is authenticity. This is a mark of the emerging church. And for this word, it's actually, there's not a lot of difference. I'll show you a funny slide. The guy, John MacArthur's got some guys that blog. And they're cute when they're angry, and they're angry a lot. So I'm going to show you one of their slides here about authenticity there. They're kind of making fun of the emerging church a little bit. But here's the protest on this issue from the emerging church. They're tired of looking in the pulpit and seeing and hearing pastors who are very rarely vulnerable about their own life. And I'm not talking about using the pulpit as a confessional. I'm talking about appropriate disclosure. And for whatever reason, I don't know if it was taught in the seminaries or modeled in the home or a combination of both, and I'm not sure how all this works. There was just a whole kind of generation of pastors who just weren't very honest about their struggles. And a lot of the younger pastors in the emerging church are reacting against that. This goes not from just from the pulpit, but to the pew. Little transparency among the people. People really not knowing what's going on. I remember the church I was serving in Kansas City, we had a couple who passed out bulletins when you would come in. And we were a secret church, so we didn't call them bulletins, we called them programs. But they passed out bulletins. And when people were coming in, and one day they announced to our guy who oversaw that ministry, we're not going to be here next week. He's like, oh, you guys going on vacation? No, our divorce is final this week, and we're not going to. He's like, you're getting a divorce. They're still passing out bulletins together, a couple. You're getting a divorce, and you haven't told anybody? Yeah, yeah. And all too often, the struggles of the people in the church are only known by the people who are struggling. And there's not a lot of room for authenticity and transparency. And the emerging church says that is wrong. It should not be that way in the pulpit. It should not be that way in the pew. Another word is community. And I'll show you another from the MacArthur's guys here. This one's good. Let me read it. Courtesy, civility, and confessions of faith are pretty much optional. We are bound together by our mutual appreciation for really cool hairstyles. If you're not sure if a guy's an emerging church pastor, look at his hair. He might be able to help you there. Spikes mean emerging, usually. Okay. But the idea of community, and I will get into this a little bit more tomorrow, that church is not just a religious activity relegated to Sunday mornings, but it's literally life together throughout the week. That we do life together. And I think that's a right correction from the emerging church. Next one is mystery. We'll show you another one. A murky, magical fog where hard truths are not supposed to exist. But this is a reaction to modernity, which exalted reason and understanding above everything else and basically set it above everything, including God. So I just ask you, do you guys all believe in the Trinity in here? You guys all understand that Trinity thing? I bet we can go over to the library and find a few books from guys who didn't understand it either. Right? They tried. You guys believe in the Incarnation? You understand it? There's mystery to our faith. And one of the great strengths of the emerging church is it's kind of brought back that mystical aspect of our faith that modernity had just kind of crushed. The arts. And the best paper I've ever read is from Jaron Bars on that, the Christianity and the Arts. So I've go get that. That's unbelievable. But the emerging church has recognized that the arts have basically been given up to the world. We basically just said, you guys can have it. We don't know what to do with those weird, freaky people. Emerging church believes, along with C.S. Lewis, that the greatest artistic works have been made by men and women who valued something else more than their art. We believe that the best artists in the world should come out of the church. Because in doing their art, it's absolutely a missional enterprise, because we're giving people a taste of the world to come. Abraham Kuyper, wonderful author who was way ahead of his time in his lectures on Calvinism, writes, "But if you confess that the world was once beautiful, but by the curse has become undone, and by a final catastrophe is to pass to its state of full glory, excelling even the beautiful paradise, then art has the mystical task of reminding us in its productions of the beauty that was lost and the anticipation of its coming luster. The arts." Another word is narrative. The emerging conversational guys read the Bible, as I said, mainly synchronically, creation, fall. And then instead of redemption, they kind of see this corporate restoration. And for years, I listened to them talk in these early conferences and interpersonally. And like, you read a book like Blue Like Jazz, you will not find a proposition in there. It's not in there. It's all narrative. And now that's gone to a point where you have what's called red letter Christians. I don't know if you've heard that term. Tony Campolo and others, where basically they're just saying, you know what, the epistles just really aren't. I'm not saying Tony Campolo is saying this for certain, but this is where I see it going. Yeah, the epistles really aren't that important because they're so proposition rich. And we don't know what to do with that, so we'll just kind of talk, just deal with what Jesus said and elevate that above the rest of the scripture. The emerging attractional guys see, as I said, creation, fall, personal redemption, and restoration. That we are in a story, that it is a narrative, and that you have to read the Bible as a story. And even expository preaching, as wonderful as it is, if it does not bring the story of the text into the greater story, gets lost and gets very moralistic very fast. And so narrative is a huge word. The emerging church is very urban-centric, which is another important word, urban-centric. They've recognized the re-urbanization of our country. In all the major cities, it's happening. And they desire to be, honestly, in the middle of the hip and the cool. And so they're planting churches and moving into cities where students, grad students, cultural elites, the poor, artists, young professionals, young families are there because of affordable housing. And because of all the white flight, most of the evangelicals have moved out of the cities, and there are no churches for all these people moving back in. So a ton of church planting in the cities. I'll show you some more of these there's a huge, if you haven't studied this, there's a huge debate about terms. Very important that when you hear a word and you hear it from somebody, ask them what they mean. Don't be afraid. Sometimes we just want to nod and pretend like, missional. We have no idea what it means. Just ask the person. If you see it in their book, email them and ask them. We just assume a lot. And there's a big debate about this. And these guys doing these posters have kind of gone back and forth. So I'll show you a few of these just for fun, and then we'll get to the Q&A. Tolerance. Let's celebrate our differences in diversity, even though you are clearly wrong. Relevance. Tell me what I want to hear or else shut up and go away. Conversation. I don't know if you can see her head there on the diving board. Because the pooling of ignorance just feels better than hard truth. Incarnational living, what would Jesus do? I'm pretty sure he'd do the kind of stuff I think is cool. All right. Contextualization, if you're such a prude, you don't cuss, you have nothing to say to me. Apologetics, orthodox, heretical, who cares? Let's just find some common ground over a beer. I think they did that one about us. I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure MacArthur's guys did that one. Okay. Generous orthodoxy. Now this is once again MacArthur's guys. Okay, it's not really either, but it sounds better than the truth. And then now we got some rebuttal going on, I think. Is that the next one? Yeah. Generous orthodoxy, because if it's not both, it's neither. So you got a kind of rebuttal going back and forth. Ecclesiology, who cares whether we know how it's supposed to work? We're going to take a crack at fixing it. Postmodern, it's our word, don't use it, don't try to define it, above all, don't label us with it, even if we apply it to ourselves. truth. It's an adventure, not an axiom. It's a story still unfolding, not a tale already told. The journey is what counts, not the destination, right? Cultural awareness, following Bono to the pub, to the earth, to the concert, to the uttermost parts of the earth. Did I say Bono? I meant Bono. Gosh, I did it myself. Sonny Bono. Bono. Missional, the new chief end of man, glorifying whatever's lowbrow and enjoying it forever. Hermeneutics, a thoroughly modern power tool used by fundamentalists to marginalize disenfranchised people groups and post-evangelicals. Deconstruction, what kind of freedom would it be if we couldn't make the Bible mean what we want it to mean? A chastened epistemology. I'm probably wrong about a lot of things, but I'm sure you are wrong about everything, and your confidence is driving me crazy. Spirituality, we like it messy. So what? Dialogue, I'll talk, you listen. Post-critical, I can't hear what you're, when you're disagreeing with me. Faith, doubt. Question everything. Okay. One of the things that's important to understand is, one of the guys asked this in the time, one of the most encouraging things to me, quite honestly, is there is actually some good dialogue going back and forth now between the two groups. And as the publishing continues to happen, you can say provocative things when you talk and kind of get away with not defining things. But when you have to write it down and you have publishers who want, you know, edits and clarification, what is happening is more and more and more we're beginning to see really what is going on for real, and the lines are being a little bit clearer. And so I think that's a good thing. And so I think more and more these things are going to flesh out. Right now, we've been in the murky, the mud in a real sense, and I think things are beginning to shake out.